This is Kim Whitler, author of Positioning for Advantage, Techniques and Strategies to Grow Brand Value, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, and thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know, and named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. I do this podcast to help me and my listeners keep up with the latest ideas that matter most in the quickly changing and somewhat overwhelming world of modern marketing and sales. My day job is running a marketing agency that helps manufacturers and industrial companies grow their revenue. To learn more about the problems we solve and how we do it, visit salesartillery.com. All right, enough yakking. Let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Dr. Kimberly Whitler to talk about her new book, Positioning for Advantage, Techniques and Strategies to Grow Brand Value, published by Columbia University Press. Kim Whitler is currently the Frank M. Sands Senior Associate Professor of Business Administration at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business, go Wahoos. Previously, she spent 20 years in general management, strategy, and marketing roles within the consumer packaged goods and retailing industries, managing global U.S. and Eastern European-based businesses. She spent most of her career at Procter & Gamble and more recently served as the general manager of the breakfast division for Aurora Foods, the CMO of David's Bridal, the country's leading bridal apparel retailer, and is an officer of PetSmart, the U.S.'s largest pet specialty retailer. She has written over 350 articles as a Forbes senior contributor and has published in Harvard Business Review, MIT Sloan Management Review, The Washington Post, Ad Age, and numerous academic journals and other publications. Her Forbes articles have garnered over 3.5 million page views, and she has been ranked as a top 5 influencer of CMOs, a top 10 influencer of tech B2B CMOs, and a top 100 MarTech influencer. She's been interviewed, cited, or quoted over 2,100 times, including the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg, the Washington Post, New York Times, NBC, ABC, USA Today, Entrepreneur, Fox Sports, Huffington Post, and a variety of international media outlets. And, interesting fact, she is an avid UVA men's basketball fan. Dr. Whitler, congratulations on Positioning for Advantage, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks so much. I'm really delighted to be here with you. I love your podcast. I love what you do, kind of frankly, for our field. And so it's quite an honor for me to be here with you today.
Oh, the honor's all mine. And I'm going to tell you why for a variety of reasons. But one is that I've been following you for years. I have mentioned you in presentations I've given. I've cited the research that you've done about boards of directors and marketing, which is very interesting, which we can certainly talk about. But let me just ask one quick question. It's just gnawing at me. You were on Fox Sports. Were you doing like a play-by-play analysis for a UVA basketball game?
No, I wish.
You could.
I really wish. No. No, actually, I was on because we have a new book coming out next year related to the NIL, Name, Image, Likeness rules, and how athlete brands can build their own brand in this new world. So I was on talking about the book that we're going to have come out.
Oh, great. Yeah. Well, I kind of thought that might be what it is because you're one of the few authors I've actually gotten to speak to before the interview. We had a telephone call this week. Normally the authors, you know, most of them want to stay away from me and I can't really blame them. So at any rate, well, it's good to have a professor from UVA. We've had professors from other great schools. And just recently, I had a Virginia Tech graduate on the show, Mike McAllowitz, and he's one of his many things he does in his books is he makes fun of UVA. So, you know, and I'm sure all the UVA people think, he's just jealous or whatever. But anyway, it's all in good fun. So there you go. Let me quote from the beginning of the book here. A couple places I wanted to quote from. You write that in a review that I made of more than 500 chief marketing officer profiles on LinkedIn, less than 10% had a degree in marketing. This means that most people who lead the marketing function in companies don't have a degree in marketing. Imagine if most chief finance officers didn't have a finance degree. And those who did study marketing in college or graduate school rarely, if ever, had courses that focused on how to do marketing. Most undergraduate courses tend to be theory or concept-based, with few using tools and workshops to teach students how to create, build, or construct successful brands. Consequently, the vast majority of marketers discover what marketing is and how to create marketing strategies and plans from their employers on the job. And then you go on to talk about how there are certain companies where they do great training. So in other words, if it is on the job, it's really well done, extremely well documented, like Procter & Gamble, for instance, or some of these other large consumer packaged goods or retailing companies that you mentioned. And then you go on to write on page 7 that, in contrast, the marketing curriculum in schools is largely theory-based with little insight into the tools that marketers can employ to create brand strategy. And then further down the page, you write, these theoretical frameworks are important foundational concepts to help students understand the strategic choices they can make. However, once the framework are understood, students should learn how to create a differentiated brand positioning or how to create a strategic positioning that gives a brand the chance to become a star. Unfortunately, there aren't many tools or guides that help students or practicing marketers understand how to do this. I call this the theory-doing gap. That's theory-doing gap, and that's going to come up again. Or the inability to convert general marketing concepts into successful business practices. And finally, one other thing I want to mention. You write, this book is designed to fill the theory doing gap by providing a series of analytical, conceptual, and exceptional and executional methods, which for clarity I will call tools, designed to help aspiring C-level marketers. It is the culmination of over 400 interviews with C-level leaders, consulting engagements with companies across different industries, and my former experience as a general manager, chief marketing officer, and current experience as a professor. I will provide insights into how to use a number of methods and tools to build a superior brand that achieves positional advantage. And finally, just one other thing I want to mention from page 15 was, in the aggregate, this book is designed to provide a foundational understanding of the key tools that marketers from more sophisticated companies, like the ones I mentioned earlier, are likely to use. While it is based on sound theory, it bridges the theory-doing gap by introducing specific yet flexible tools that can help you implement marketing strategies and plans. Whether you are a seasoned marketer or a novice, or you just work with marketers, this book is designed to move beyond theory and help you better understand how to employ the right marketing tools to have more success creating, building, and growing brands. So on page 4, I noticed you said that a common question that you hear from students and managers alike is, what is it that marketers do? And it reminded me of one of the finest movies in American film history, Office Space, where the two Bobs, the two consultants, are asking this guy, and they said, what exactly do you do here? So what, when you hear that question, what's your response to the question, what is it that marketers do?
Well, first of all, I have to tell you, I feel like I'm getting ready for a quiz. When you started reading all these different excerpts from the book, which is terrific, I'm like, okay, where is he going to go with this question? One of the things, you know, at Darden, we get a lot of top MBA students. Most want to go into investment banking or consulting. Very few come to Darden because they want to go into marketing. And so, you know, and I get them at the beginning of the quarter. And what happens is that most of these students are like, why do I have to take marketing? Because I really want to get to my finance class or to something that's relevant for consulting. And so what really happens is trying to help them understand the value the value of marketing in terms of what it contributes to firm performance. Like, why do marketers exist? And so that's where I start. I don't give them the answer. I'm like, we're going to start the course, and I have a question for you. What is the purpose of marketing? Mm. Why is it that marketers exist? You know, and so.
And what do they say? What do they say?
Well, at the beginning, everybody, here are some of my favorite quotes. Marketing is jazz hands, right? Oh. Okay. That came from a student this year, and he said, Joe said, I always thought marketing was jazz hands. Now I realize it's not. And this is, for me, very gratifying because
yes.
I know I'm moving it from this thing that is very mystical and it seems like it's all luck to something that actually is more systematic, it's data-based, it's scientific, it's strategic, it's not luck. And so that's one term. Another term I got a couple years back from Jesse. These are some of my favorite students. Like three-fourths of the way through the course, he said, you know, Kim, and he said this to the whole class. He said, I always thought marketing was arts and crafts. I now realize it's not. And so where we go in the course is I help them understand that our job, our unique job, is to help drive growth for the firm. We're one of the only functions that's output oriented, that's focused on the external universe, the environment, to try to figure out how we can architect, kind of engineer, if you will, growth for the firm.
Mm, that is so interesting. And would some of these MBAs not have studied business as undergrads, or I guess they'd never had marketing classes or anything like that?
Well, yeah, many might come from engineering. We have the beauty today is that we have people who come who are teachers, who come from Teach for America, or who come from nonprofits, or who come from business. They come from all walks of life, and that's the beauty of having an MBA classroom today, because we have diversity of experience that helps us think about these business problems in a more holistic way. You know, some obviously come into the classroom as marketers. They understand their version of marketing.
Oh, could be off as well.
Yes. I mean, I have a story from a student. This is my very first year. He's an excellent student. He's now at BCG doing very well. But he came into my office and he was perplexed. He said, Kim, this is not marketing. You are not teaching us marketing. And I said, interesting. I said, so tell me what you think marketing is. So if this isn't marketing, what is marketing? And so he started talking to me about what they did at his company. And I asked him, I said, do you think it's possible that other companies think of marketing and have a definition of marketing and a role for marketing that might be different? And he said, sure. And I said, do you think that marketing was leveraged at your firm? Do you think it was a priority? It was managed well? You had built a really superior marketing capability relative to other companies? And he said, no. And I said, that's why I'm not teaching you that version of marketing. So what we're teaching here is a view of marketing when marketing drives the bus, when marketing is the P&L driver for the firm, mm-hmm. when marketing helps drive the strategic position for the firm, and then helps lead development of innovation, not a view, and this is in my research, this was in an HBR article a few years ago, half of marketers are only downstream marketers. And what I mean is somebody else at a tech firm is designing the product. And then they hand the product to marketers, and marketers are only there to commercialize the product and the strategic direction that somebody else decided. That's not how we teach it. We teach it when companies want to use marketing as kind of the P&L driver, and as they want to focus on marketing in that capacity. Mm. So this is a case where many people have experienced marketing, and their experience is based on their own company or the companies that they've worked for or the companies that they've seen. And that is not representative of all of the different ways in which companies conceive of, design, and leverage marketing. And so what we're trying to do is use the version that we believe builds the best marketing capability for a firm.
You're reading my mind, because I was just looking at page 6 where you talk about 50% of companies treat marketing, this is based on your work you mentioned, They treat marketing as only a sales activity existing just to commercialize the product that other firm leaders create. In such scenarios, marketers are typically isolated in downstream roles with others in the firms defining the strategic direction and developing the innovation pipeline. But this also underscores a point that I've made now for years about how, you know, marketers have an image problem, whether it's fair or not. It's not based on some hostility. It's just a lack of understanding. And that perception is that marketers, many marketers are perceived as arts and crafts party planners who work in the make it pretty department. Or as our British listeners would say, the coloring in department. Well, let's get on to some of the key concepts from the book. And I wanted to go to chapter 2, actually, on page 19, and quote from Lee Susan, who's the chief sales and marketing officer for McElhaney. That's the Tabasco company, right?
Exactly.
Yes. You quoted her as saying, most companies focus on product development, how to create a superior product. However, great marketing companies know that a truly superior positioning concept anchored in deep consumer insight is what should lead a successful product development process. Unfortunately, most companies don't know how to create a superior positioning concept. And then later on that page, you write that, you know, this could very likely be related to why, you know, up to 90% of new products fail because they're coming up with the product first. And I see this all the time I read about this all the time, and I've seen it as well. Talk to us about what is a positioning concept and why is it important and why do so few companies use it?
So first of all, let me say Lee, he is actually partnered with me in developing my elective. So I've known him for several years, and he and I kind of worked together to create this new to the world elective. And he's currently chief sales and marketing officer for McElhaney, and trying to really drive innovation for them.
And does he keep you plied with Tabasco sauce though?
You know what? Our family, we are nutty Tabasco consumers. So he actually used to be at E&J Gallo, and he moved to McElhaney within the last couple years. And I told him that my sister's first dog was named Tabasco, Tabby for short. I mean, she has apparel with Tabasco. So he was like, my gosh, you know, you are our rabid fans. Yes. So when he comes into the classroom, I'm like the biggest fan of Tabasco, and I make a big deal about that. But so your question is what is this positioning concept? I'm going to share a story with you about kind of when I realized the aha in the educational environment. So I had created an elective and it had all these tools in it. It was a gap that I saw, that I heard globally existed for marketing education. The former president of the AMA said that we just don't have tools. We have a lot of theory. And then I was hearing the same thing from students, which is we want to know how to do something in marketing, not just understand 2x2s and Venn diagrams. And so I went off and I then created this whole class with all of these tools, et cetera. And here at the end of the course, one of the projects was that they had to identify kind of a positioning for a new product. And I had a student who came to me. He was an entrepreneurial, he was focused on entrepreneurship. And he had built this really cool watch. And he had spent all of this time iterating the watch. And by the way, I could give you several stories just like the one I'm going to give you. He spent all this time iterating this watch. And it was what he called kind of a nag for when you're drinking. So it's targeting young kids who, when they're out, it basically is a biofeedback watch, and it would tell you when you've had too much to drink. And I'm sitting there, and immediately I'm like, as you probably could imagine, why is that a great solution? Like, what problem do young people have in terms of drinking too much, and how many want to actually be nagged for drinking too much? Is this really an issue that exists in the marketplace?
If I were wearing it, it would be going off all the time.
Well, how many young people who overdrink want to know that they're overdrinking or be nagged about it so that they stop?
Isn't that the point? Yeah.
It's not a problem. I think that is significant. And so I asked him, I said, what research have you done? First of all, so your target's young people. Yes. And what research have you done to identify how big the market is for that problem? So you've created a solution, but is there a significant, is there really a problem in the marketplace for this? And he said, I've done none. And I said, well, how are you going to position it? Because we were talking about potential distribution options. I said, well, how do you position? He goes, what do you mean? I said, well, how do you actually frame what you're offering so that you can communicate that to distribution partners or to consumers, et cetera? And this was a concept he had not thought about. And I mean, again, I can go on and on. I've got another incidents where somebody created a great product, but when I came, when it came down to how are you going to position this and for whom, like who are you creating value for and what is the value that you're creating beyond the product that you've iterated 200 times, they don't know what I'm saying. And so at that moment I said, okay, there's a big gap in how we're helping young people understand how to build successful businesses. The typical way that they do it, and I have an example in the book of the coat checks guy, is that a young person has a problem. He or she then goes and solves the problem. They create a product to solve their own personal problem. They don't know how rampant this problem is, how big it is. Is there a market for this problem, or is this something that's unique for you? What else exists to solve this problem? Are there alternative solutions? All of these questions have to be considered. And then you think about, how am I going to position my solution so that it's unique in the marketplace? It's better and different from competitive solutions. It's relevant for the consumer. And oh, by the way, there's a big enough market that makes this appealing to go invest my time and energy on. None of that stuff have they thought about. They've designed and iterated hundreds, thousands of times a product. They have a widget. Now I've got to go commercialize it. What have they forgotten to do? All the upfront stuff, all the strategic work that should come before they go to build the product. And so that's when I started, again, I created a different elective for my students. And it's all around, how do you identify a new to the world opportunity for a company, and then how do you position it? And that's the project that I worked on with Lee. And what we have the students do in 1 week, teach them all the tools. They have to then go identify a new to the world product. They have to literally articulate the positioning. They have to test it with consumers, quantitatively test it. They have to iterate the positioning, and then they have to present it to our client. In this case, it's Lee and McElhaney. And then Lee uses that as part of his feeder into his innovation pipeline at McElhaney. So it's not wasted work. He actually identifies the space that they're interested in. He gives it to our students. They go do the consulting work for him, and then it feeds into his innovation pipeline. So that's a kind of a winded way of explaining it, but there's this big gap that should come before product development. And for many companies, they don't realize this.
Yes. And that example about that alarm for the alcohol, that wasn't in the book, right?
No.
Okay, so to the listener, I just want to say that is a Marketing Book Podcast extra. There's no extra charge for this. So what I want to talk to you about, there's an entire book that was on the show a couple years ago about this very thing, just this one part. And it's a Silicon Valley marketing executive, MIT grad, Jill Soley. And she wrote a book called Beyond Product, and it goes into a lot of this in more depth. But she talks in the book about how, oh gosh, almost every week she meets an executive, usually a tech executive, who more or less laments, "I've got a great product. Why am I not minting money?" And it's exactly what we're talking about. And I was almost in disbelief as I read her book. I was thinking, really? You run into this a lot? She said, oh, Douglas, you wouldn't believe. So anyway, I will include a link to her interview at your episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com so folks can find it. But there, you include, you know, this is eminently a practical book with lots of exercises and real granular details. But there's a process you have in here about how to go about, you know, this positioning concept. And I just wanted to ask you about phase one, okay, folks? The very first phase is, identify the consumer problem. Just to not to put too fine a point on it, but I gather it's almost like I'm asking Jill Soley this, but this outside in approach, you know, going to the consumers first, do you find that that's more rare?
You know, it really is. And what I find even more interesting is almost every company will say that they're customer-centered, they're consumer-centered. They will say that. And then I talk, and what I start doing is I start asking questions about, well, help me understand how you innovate. How do you, and it's almost always, well, you know, we've got a technical team, they're working on something and they find an opportunity. No, that's not outside in. Outside in is you literally start and you look at the, you know, at the marketplace. I'll give you an interesting example of this. This is, again, another free edition.
Free. You know, you're just dropping value bombs all over the place, Dr. Whitler. And for that, I thank you.
So, you know, you would think a company like P&G, you know, most kind of marketing-centered, growth-centered, consumer-centered companies tend to be outside in. But interestingly, way back when I was there in the right around 1990, 91, 92, one of the things that we found is that we had an upstream think tank that was working on all sorts of cool upstream technologies. And so then the question that the head of the sector asked was, well, who's handing the opportunities to that team? Is it based on understanding global consumer habits and practices and needs? Or is it upstream technologists working on technology that they see embedded in science? And what he then did, the head of the sector said, and he tasked me with it, so this is why I know this fairly intimately, is he said, go off around the globe. We looked at 13 different countries trying to understand laundry habits and practices and identifying the biggest opportunity that existed in the marketplace. And what was interesting is the biggest opportunity was not sexy from a technology or science perspective. It was just a huge opportunity. And it was not something that was a priority for our upstream think tank. And so this is a class. I mean, even the best companies, sometimes, you know, those that are outside in struggle with doing this. But that's the whole essence, is that you have to start by trying to understand the marketplace and the consumer, what their problems are. Is it a big problem? Is it something that you have unique skill and that you can bring to bear to solve that problem? But it is step one, start with a consumer.
Yeah, it brings to mind a book from, gosh, maybe 25 years ago by Randall Rothenberg, who was the advertising columnist for the New York Times. And he wrote this book called Where the Suckers Moon, and it was a wonderful book. And it was all about Subaru hiring a new ad agency years ago. And there's one story he tells in the book about how, I guess after World War II, Subaru, like a lot of companies, really, really driven by the engineers and the technical people, and they would develop the best, most interesting engineered car that they or product that they could. And then they would turn downstream to the marketing people and say, go sell this. And apparently, Toyota had a different approach where they would just go talk to customers and get insights, and then they would turn to the engineers and say, build this.
Well, you know what I always get when we talk about this? It's so fascinating. What do we get in the U.S. when you start talking about starting with consumer research? We get Steve Jobs, right? Jobs said, we don't need to listen to the consumer. That's what he said. And then I'll bring up and I'll say, well, and Henry Ford said this. Henry Ford said, if you ask the consumer what they'd want, they say a faster horse. Mm-hmm. And so I said, excellent. So that means we should never talk to consumers, right? Mm-hmm. And I said, I actually think we are misunderstanding their points. I actually think what they're saying, they're both saying, implied, is that the consumer cannot design a car and the consumer cannot design an untethered phone. What the consumer can do, though, is tell you what their pain points are. If the consumer is telling you that they want a faster horse, your company has to figure out how to achieve that. One way may be through a faster horse, make them leaner. I don't know. Another way, though, may be to create something that is faster than a horse. So I actually think in both of these scenarios, consumer insight helps you identify the pain point, but the consumer is not the designer. they're not the engineer. And interestingly, I did some work over in Asia, Tencent, and I was put in touch with a number of different executives. I actually happened to talk with the head of marketing from Oppo. Oppo is one of the world's largest cell phone manufacturers. And you know what he talked about? He definitely did not sound like an American tech person. He talked about how many miles he spent traveling to all corners of China, listening to consumers. And he didn't speak English, so we had a translator. And some of the beauty of the translation was amazing. He said, the insight hides behind the numbers on the page. Oh. The data hides the insight. And just the beauty in the translation was amazing. This was a guy who was more in touch with consumer insight than, frankly, most of the folks I've interviewed in tech in the U.S. And I thought, isn't that interesting? He had not heard or had not been exposed to or did not adhere to that kind of Steve Jobs view that we don't need to listen to the consumers, we'll build it ourselves.
That is really interesting. But, you know, I have also read that Steve Jobs, maybe he said that, maybe he didn't, but he had deep insights
yes.
into his consumers. And there was another book on the show, which is one of my all-time favorites, is Buyer Personas by Adele Rovella. And is probably one of the best books that's been on the show about how to get insights into your customers. And in that book, because she's heard that same thing throughout her career about Steve Jobs. And she said, okay, first off, if there's a Steve Jobs at your company, you don't need to be reading this book. You probably don't have one. And stop thinking that. And actually, there was another book on the show a while back called The Ultimate Startup Guide. It was about by Tom Hogan and Carol Broadbent about tech, you know, startup marketing. And in that book, they talked about how the legend of Steve Jobs was one of the worst things to happen to tech CEOs because mm-hmm. they all thought they were supposed to sort of ape him, you know, mimic him and do what he was doing. And then they came back to it at the very end of the book and they said, here's what you don't understand about Steve Jobs. He made a lot of mistakes, but he learned from his mistakes and came back. So,
well, and I, you know, my, like in my gut, what I worry about when there's this belief that one person can magically predict the market, that violates the law of statistics. Okay. Yes. The whole point of marketing, is that I, Kim, do not represent all women. I don't represent all professors. N of one is not generalizable. Mm-hmm. And so marketers, what we uniquely do is we put aside our own views to try to deeply go understand the breadth of our target consumer, mm-hmm. to deeply understand them and bring that view inside the company. And so what this also does with Steve Jobs being able to kind of somehow intuit what all consumers need and want is it sets up an expectation that there are people who can do this. And those people then don't need to listen to the consumer or data. And I think that's a little bit potentially, you know, dangerous because again, it just violates the law of statistics.
Yeah. It's not good odds.
No.
Well, let's just conclude this section. I just wanted to quote from one of my favorite lines in the book, which is on page 40, where you write, "The better you become at generating deep consumer understanding and converting it into superior ideas, the more effective you will be across your entire professional career. The ability to understand others' problems and create effective solutions lies at the heart of being a good employee, a good CEO, a good politician, a good marketer, a good boss, and a good spouse or friend." I could see that one up on a big slide for an upcoming presentation I have. It's so funny, you know. And you know, you don't have to completely understand these consumers, but you do need to understand them just a little bit better than your competition. And the results I've seen are dramatic. Let's go into a couple of definition things here. I can't resist. In that section on the brand essence statement, which is chapter 3, just for the record, Dr. Whitler, what is a brand?
Well, I will tell you, I'll tell you my shorthand. I've got a specific definition in the book that says it's a distinguishing name and or symbol intended to identify the goods or services of either one seller or a group of sellers and to differentiate those goods or services from those of competitors. the way I describe it to students is it's basically everything. It's all the associations that people have when they see your name or you know, see a brand name or see a logo or hear it. So it's the accumulation of how people think and feel about something.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of it may come from, oh gosh, hundreds, thousands of just little interactions or things they've seen, the experience they may have already had with the product or the service or the people that work there, that type of thing. Over the years, I've passed on some books about brands and branding because when I've looked into them, not all of them, but a number of them think that it's still something that the marketing department can control.
Mm.
It's left there. And when we spoke this week, I was mentioning the book by the Strattons on branding. And they were talking about really your HR department may have more to do with your brand than what your marketing people are doing and saying.
Well, you know, just to make this point super vivid, I was with a group of scholar athletes yesterday from UVA. We're talking about the NIL content. And I said, so what is an athlete brand? Okay. And we talked about, I said, where does it come from? How does it get established? Well, it's everything you do and say. I said, well, what does that mean? Is it just how you perform on the court? How about what you're doing when the camera comes to you and you're sitting on the sidelines and you're goofing off? How about what you do at practice? How about when a fan sees you in public? How about, you know, when you're in class? How do you show up in class?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, the brand is everything you do and say. And I said, this is such, you know, responsibility for a young person. You know, yeah. We don't even have that. I can go out in public and I'm anonymous. Ty Jerome can't. He goes out, people know who he is. He's a young man. Everything he does goes, so I said, is your brand only what you post on social media? No, it's a combination of all of this stuff. Right. And so,
including what other people are saying.
Yep. Yep. And so I saw Ty Jerome at a restaurant and I saw how kindly he was to the, you know, the treatment he gave to the waitress. I go on social media and say, what a nice young gentleman Ty Jerome is. And so, you know, very little of it is necessarily, and they can control it in terms of how they behave, but they can't control where it goes from there.
Right. Well, let me ask you two other terms that come up and I think mean different things to different people, but this is real important as it relates to your book. Then, what then is a brand image? And can you talk about the brand essence statement, which was another very central part of the book?
Yeah. So again, I'll stick with my NIL athlete brand. So I said, what is a brand image, right? It's the thoughts and associations held by those people that you may be targeting. So it could be the image held by fans if you're trying to get to the NBA. It could be the image held by the scouts or the image held by the coaches or the general managers. So the image is actually, I said, well, isn't the, if I have a brand image, isn't it what I think it is, Kim Whitler? And they said, no, it's not. You know, that may be my brand essence statement. That's my brand strategy. That's what I want to stand for.
Mm-hmm.
But the brand image is actually what you do stand for. So the way that marketers oftentimes measure this is that we have brand image reports that talk about, you know, what is the image of Tide versus, you know, all the other products in the category? What does it stand for on cleaning performance? What does it stand for on, you know, softening performance, on all sorts of different attributes? Now what we're doing is we're taking a look at all the individuals out there that know about Tide, have a perception of Tide, and we're looking at the data on what Tide actually stands for in the minds and hearts of those people.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the image. The essence statement is essentially, look, there's so many, you know, some companies will call it your brand architecture, okay? Which I have historically referred to because that's how I was trained, but academics think about brand architecture differently, so I did not call it that. Some will call it your brand strategy. In this book, I'm calling it brand essence statement. And it's essentially, if you think about it, the pieces and parts of how you want to build the brand. So if you work in construction, you have a blueprint. And that blueprint has all the lines and the dots, and it explains exactly how we're supposed to build a house or build you know, a building. In this case, the brand essence statement are all of those pieces and parts. It's the strategic view of how you want to build the brand. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And you mentioned the building. So in your book on page 50, you've got the whole the Parthenon here, you know, of the brand essence. In other words, all the things that go into brand essence, which is interesting. You know, it's got the emotional benefits, the rational benefits, and then all those pillars of what people need to believe, you know, the proof, and then as well as the personality and the brand values. So it's all put together. It's very clear, but I still, it seems like it's you're helping to deconstruct what people think is like magic or sorcery or something. Is that some of the reaction you get from some of your students?
Yeah. Yes. So what this is it is a deconstruction of, it's the pieces and parts of what you want the brand to stand for and how you're, it's not necessarily how you're going to get there, but the direction that you're going in. And so this is a strategy document. It's not something that you necessarily show to people outside of marketing, because most people would say, I don't understand necessarily what this is. But we have to figure out, as in marketing, we have to figure out how should we go innovate? What's the direction that we're going in? Mm-hmm. Well, what do we stand for? I can give you an example. Way back when on Tide, our positioning was around superior cleaning performance. And all of a sudden, there are all these technologies that were potentials that went beyond cleaning performance, but our brand stood for cleaning. So we either had to change our positioning and open the aperture to allow for other technologies and innovations, or we had to ignore all those innovations. And I'll tell you, I think this is where Crest went wrong in the 90s. What had happened was Crest had been anchored since the 1940s on tartar control, right? And so they're the best on tartar control, more dentists recommended, et cetera, et cetera. Well, at some point in North America, the needs of consumers moved beyond cleaning of teeth to actual oral care, to also the aesthetics of teeth. And so Crest hadn't repositioned themselves. They stayed there. What did Colgate do? Colgate came out with Colgate Total. It was the first time in, I believe, 50 years that they overtook marketplace leadership, because Crest had still been anchored on a need that had been important for several decades, but consumer needs had shifted beyond that. On Tide, similar thing faced Tide. It had been historically anchored on cleaning and dirt removal, but the needs of an evolving North American society, a first world country, beyond kind of getting dirt out, we had to reposition the brand to ensure that we were staying relevant on the most important problems that mattered to consumers, because we were the leader in the marketplace. We had to evolve the positioning. And so what this is literally the pieces and parts of what that brand strategy is going to be, that then directs your innovation pipeline. It directs your promotions. It directs, you know, it can even affect how you think about your go-to-market plan.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move on to the part of the book that got me probably the most fired up. It's about values-based marketing. And it's, I guess you could argue it's a newer trend or a newer buzzword. And I've seen some conflicting advice about this, and I'm a little worried that certain companies or certain brands are getting bad advice, or maybe they're making some long-term mistakes. Can you explain what values-based marketing is and what some of the potential pitfalls are, or maybe even just some examples of what you're seeing companies get wrong?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you think about it, what do the following brands have in common? Coca-Cola, Nike, Starbucks, Gillette. All of them have had brouhahas around what I call values-based marketing. Another way of thinking about this is purpose. I mean, what happens is, another way to think about it is purpose-based kind of marketing that goes awry. And it's the shift. It is a shift to try to position. It's really to position brands on what marketers think is more meaningful to consumers. I think what's happening is there's a lot of research that is misleading marketers. I can go find no less than 10 or 15 studies that show that consumers want brands to stand up. They want brands to stand up for their values, to express their values, etc. But in many cases, what's happening is this is a numbers problem. It's a math problem. What it does is it forces the companies to kind of pick a position that is very polarizing. And when they do that, they then alienate a group of their consumers. And as growth engineers, we start from the position that we're trying to grow our consumer base, drive positive affinity, not alienate them. And I can give you an example of, I think it was Gillette, when Gillette did the toxic masculinity, and they were trying to, it had nothing to do with a shave. It had nothing to do with their razors. What they were trying to do was to call on men to be better. The way that the ad came across for some was very, a lot of men at the time, they thought it was very offensive. Mm-hmm. It was basically painting men, all men, because it's one ad, and so it's representing men. It's painting men as being kind of bullies and thugs and chauvinistic pigs. Mm-hmm. And this is a little shocking because, of course, their target are men, so it's probably not something that you would naturally want to do to your target. And here's an example I used. Can you imagine a female razor company coming out with an ad that says toxic femininity. Mm. It just would not happen. And so this is a case where Gillette came out and they antagonized the consumers. They ended up losing some market share over the following year. And somebody in an article literally said that they did more to help their competitors' shares than an enormous amount of marketing had ever done. And so this is a case where companies that are focusing on showing how virtuous they are, we're going to advertise our values, they end up, and they typically are doing this on some polarizing positions, it ends up antagonizing a certain group of their consumer base and gets them into hot water. Coca-Cola just did it this year when they came out on the Georgia voting reform law. They started off in a neutral position. The left called for a boycott. So Coke rapidly moved to the left and adopted the liberal position on this law.
It was against the law. It was against the voting law. Okay.
Yeah, no, they were against the reform. Mm-hmm. And then what happened? The conservatives came out and they called for a boycott. And I said, this is an example where Coke was an equal opportunity offender. They alienated both sides of the party. And I know people at both Pepsi and Keurig Dr. Pepper. And when this came out, both companies were absolutely thrilled. Right? Because how much advertising would it take to try to move people's perception of a brand? But when Coke did this, all of a sudden, when they aligned, and I've talked with some folks in reputation management area, et cetera, as soon as you pick, if you're a mass brand, and as soon as you align on even one issue that is political, you have sent a signal to your entire mass consumer base that you are generally aligned with that political ideology. Now, again, as I come back to the math problem, if I have 10 consumers, 3 are liberal, 3 are conservative, and 4 are in the middle, why would I want to align on any political side of an issue? Mm-hmm. What you're doing is you're jeopardizing potentially the consumers that are in the middle or on the other side. The answer, of course, is always, well, it's to do the right thing. And I've got a case that I've written on this Coke situation and an exercise. And the answer is always, well, it's to do the right thing. And so I say, excellent. What is the right thing on the Georgia voting reform law? What is the right? And they always say, well, it's very clearly X. And I said, according to whom? You. Now let's go spend some time and let's practice perspective taking. How do conservatives feel about this issue? How do liberals feel about this issue? How do your conservative employees feel? How do your liberal employees, how do your conservative shareholders, your liberal shareholders, by the way, 80% of their business is overseas. How do people in the Czech Republic care about the Georgia voting reform law? How does that affect them? You have a very big tent, and how do all of these constituents think about this? And in their mind, what is the right answer? Well, once you go through that exercise, you're like, I don't know what's right. Everybody has a different view on this issue. And one of the beautiful things on this exercise is I brought in a reputation management expert. What he did with the group is he pulled up a group that had written a statement for the Coke CEO. That was the exercise. You have to go write a statement that Coke should have written. And of course, this group happened to align with the liberal side of the issue. And so the reputation management guy played a CNN reporter and he started asking questions. And he asked questions like, on page 90, you know, are you for or against this part of the law? On page 87, are you for or against this part of the law? Well, since you're against this law, where do you stand on the Texas abortion law? And you could just watch the student who started squirming going, oh my gosh, what did I just step in?
Yeah.
And that's the challenge when you start, especially on these polarizing issues, oftentimes come down to political ideology. If you are a mass brand, this is incredibly problematic. Now, if you are Patagonia, if you're Chick-fil-A, if you're Ben and Jerry's, your brand from the beginning has been clear and it is aligned with an ideology, and that's okay. Consumers know it. They expect it. But they don't expect it from mass brands like Nike, Coke, Pepsi, Gillette, etc. And that's when, you know, the companies are challenged because they're trying to stand up for something. And what's happening is they're turning off consumers and affecting the core positioning of their brand. They're affecting their positioning and they're not even realizing it.
Mm. Very interesting. Now, so what could have Coke said? Something like, look, we're all about refreshment. We don't want to get involved in politics.
Well, you know, working with, and I have to give him a plug. His name's Adam Goodman, and he is a partner at Ballard Partners. He's actually worked on a number of winning political campaigns, but now what he does is he advises companies on how to navigate these issues. That's what he does. And he said, the challenge here is I don't know how you escape unscathed, because generally the research shows that those on the conservative side are okay with neutrality. Those on the left, especially the far left, aren't okay with that. And so you actually can't escape these things unscathed. And he said, there's a couple of kind of key points. He said, it's better to get bloodied than buried. he said, you may be bloodied because there's going to be a fringe group who will never let go. And he said, but if you cater to them, you're in deep trouble. And that's where you have to kind of keep your head up. He said, but the goal here is that you find a unifying concept. You find a unifying way of thinking about this. And in here, everybody supports kind of free and fair elections. And so what you would do is come out with a statement that aligns with your purpose, with your values, your company's values. Coke is about inclusion. So it almost makes no sense to pick a side in which you're then excluding people. And so, what they could do is come out with a unifying statement, which they ultimately kind of ended up at. But they did it through, you know, trying to start in the middle. They really catered far left. And then they tried to come back and they have a statement on their website about this that's much more neutral.
Expensive lesson learned.
Well,
I say expensive. I don't know about their sales, but I think, didn't their
brand value
that's monitored go down?
Yeah, it did. They lost brand value. This is by Brand Finance. Keurig Dr. Pepper went up about 40% this last year. Pepsi was about flat, but I believe that Coke dropped about 13%. And I'll tell you part of what's getting Coke in trouble is if you look at their purpose is to refresh the world, make a difference. And so that make a difference almost leads them into significant activism efforts. Mm. Pepsi's brand purpose is to create more smiles with every sip and every bite. And so Pepsi could actually stand up and say, well, you know, weighing in on a specific political issue is actually inconsistent with our purpose. Our goal, our goal as a company is to help create more joy and more smiles. Mm-hmm. And so they could actually sidestep it because it's inconsistent with their purpose. But Coke has said, we're here to make a difference. So bring it on any and all issues. anything that could make a difference, we need to be weighing in on. And so I think that that actually is leading them into a tough position, frankly.
Interesting. Well, let's move on to a few other key concepts from the book that I really want to emphasize for the listener. And that's the chapter on strategy map types. Okay, and I want to read, it's on page 73. You say, consider the following scenario. Imagine making a presentation to a board of directors for the first time. What is the best way to distill your understanding of the business into a few short, simple to understand Microsoft PowerPoint slides? The first time I presented to a board, this was the challenge, conveying in a few slides what I had digested by looking at hundreds of pages of data and reports. To influence and communicate effectively, I relied heavily on strategy maps. I love the perceptual map. You've even got one on the cover of your book. I know you're not crazy about the cover that they ended up with, but what is a strategy map? And explain why they are so powerful, which as I read this chapter, I realized why I've always loved perceptual maps, but that's just one of many.
Yeah, I mean, a way to think about them is that they're tools that help enable marketers to communicate a complex topic in a more digestible fashion via a visual. So the visual oftentimes identifies and situates kind of key variables that you might be looking at. But essentially what it is it's a power that communicates, it's a picture that communicates. And they can be used in a couple of different ways. So, you know, they can be used to actually help distill information and make decisions. Right. So when I talked to you about P&G and we had 13 different, you know, countries and we were looking at the needs and everything, a way in which we help make sense of the data or to look at the global brands is to put that into a picture with all the key information. And all of a sudden, it kind of would illuminate marketplace opportunities. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you can use it on that side. The other very obvious way, and consulting firms do this a lot. Like, what is the key superpower that consulting firms oftentimes have? This is what they do, right? they come in, they look at 300 pages or 500 documents, and then they put it into pictures and they feed it back to you. So they're a conversion machine to help make sense of your data through pictures and simple to easy understand images that help you make decisions or help communicate. And so they can be powerful tools in communicating. And I have to say, you know, I underappreciated this until I became more senior in my role. And I had a boss who had come from a consulting firm. And I knew that the key thing I could learn from him was how does he think about converting information into pictures, PowerPoint slides, et cetera, to help communicate and sell and influence others. And it can be a real superpower. The other thing I will tell you, one of the reasons why I started prioritizing this is because I heard a lot from students is, well, can you give me a framework? Give me the way to understand the world. And so part of what I do when I'm teaching is I say, you guys are moving into multi-$100,000 roles. You're being hired to provide them with the framework. You have to go create the picture. And so I have all these exercises where I say, you're in the position, I'm not going to give you a framework. You go create a framework of, help me explain to somebody the beverage aisle in a grocery store. Go to the beverage aisle, take a look at it, and come back with a way through pictures of explaining that category of products. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and the more you practice this, the more you use it, the better you are at it. And now frankly, through my academic training and then through my prior training, a lot of times when I'm talking with people, it's how can I take what I'm trying to communicate and convert it into a picture? Mm-hmm. That's what I did yesterday with the students when we're talking about a brand. I didn't give them definitions. I created a picture that helped them understand how all of this stuff work together to help build their brand asset that they could then monetize.
Yeah. So some of them are that you go into explain here, the BCG, Boston Consulting Group, or the McKinsey Matrix, the perceptual map, the balanced scorecard, then one called strategic control, and even the payoff matrix. So those are all in there. And I had to chuckle. I even underlined it when you say, you wrote, a key reason that companies hire consultants is to convert complex information into stories about how the business works and what should be done to address a key problem. So let's go on to the strategic marketing plan. You quote A.G. Lafley, CEO of Procter & Gamble, and they're talking about strategy. And the quote says, it's about winning. It's not about just playing the game. It's about winning. And you need to be very clear what winning means. In our view, it means three things. Uniquely positioning a firm in its industry, creating sustainable advantage, and delivering superior value versus the competition. It's important that you make the necessary choices to get all three elements right. There's a mindset among CEOs and other leaders that they don't want to get pinned down or painted into a corner. They want to keep all their options open. Why do they do that? Because they don't want to take on the risk of making a bad choice or a wrong choice. But the fact is, strategy is all about making choices, choosing where you're going to play and how you're going to win, along with what winning means. So again, back to the definitions, set us straight. What exactly is a strategic marketing plan? And if you could, talk about why marketers and other leaders struggle to develop effective strategic plans.
Yeah, you know, it was kind of embedded in that quote, but a strategic marketing plan really is the set of choices that you make regarding how you're going to position your brand in the marketplace so that you create advantage. So it's really a set of choices. And this, I actually, because I do a lot of work with executives, with C-level executives, and this is one of the sessions that I do that really, they really, really love, because I create an exercise where I help show them the problem that they have in strategic planning. And that is that what we tend to do is we say, okay, let's come up with a plan to deliver something. And then you go and you write down all the things you can do. What we fail to do is to say, if you can only do one thing, we fail on the choice making. Mm-hmm. If you can only do one thing, what is the one thing that you would do? Because what happens is when we look at that plan, we go, gosh, does this feel comprehensive? This feels like if we do this well, we're going to win. The problem is that the more things you have, the less likely it is for you to execute anything really well. And in my research, I find that implementation is oftentimes even more important than strategy. Pick a strategy, but really, really, really execute it well. And so what happens is that when you have more, you know, you aren't choiceful, you have more things on the plate, then you end up sacrificing implementation. I'll give you an example. Here's what I do with junior executives. I show them this tool. I say, I want you to go home and you have to develop a strategic plan to achieve, you know, the optimal health for yourself. So the vision is I want to achieve optimal health. What are your objectives? What are your key strategic choices, et cetera? And what happens is they fill out the page. That's what we do. I have one page. I have my tool. Let me go fill it up. And then we work through it in class. We go through all this. And at the very end, I ask them, how likely do you think it is that you're going to be able to execute all this well? And nobody believes that they can execute it. They've created a plan that they, and I said, why? And when they start thinking about it, they're like, we don't have time. Okay, so then what happens to your plan? Do you throw the whole thing out? Or now all of a sudden, you're inadvertently, not in a choiceful way, you're actually making puts and calls. You're saying, oh, I'm going to do this one item, but not this item. Mm-hmm. And then I said, and by the way, this is just a strategic plan for your health. How about a strategic plan for your finances, your strategic plan for your career, your strategic plan for your family? That's your whole life. Okay, if we went and did all those plans, you would be overwhelmed. And so now all of a sudden, our strategic planning exercise has been rendered ineffective because you literally can't execute. And so I said, let's do this differently. If your goal is to do X, what is the one thing on this piece of paper that's going to give you the best chance to accomplish X? And all of a sudden, that's when the light bulb comes on, because they say, oh, wow, this is a different way of really making tough choices. Now, I actually was offered my job by A.G. Lafley. I interned at Procter, and A.G. gave me my full-time offer. And one of the most powerful things I really am grateful to P&G for is he was really ruthless and rigorous about choice making. And so I learned at a very, you know, it'd be questions like, okay, you have three core strategies that you're going to employ to build this business. What was the fourth strategy that you left off the paper? Mm. Why were those three the right three? And then why is that combination the right combination? P&G was really tough on making sure that our strategic plan was going to give us the best chance to accomplish our goals. Hmm. And I actually think that this is a big weakness in general. Again, we create a plan, but there's not much assessment or rigor in making sure that that is the right, best plan to help us accomplish our goals.
Yes, it brought to mind the expression I picked up from another book on the show years ago, where Rebecca Geyer said, "You have to say no to grow." It seems to be so counterintuitive, but her book was Smart Marketing for Engineers, but she talked about Southwest Airlines and they only had one airplane. So that was one of the decisions. They said, no, we're not going to get a lot of different airplanes. We're only going to get 737s. And there were certain decisions where they purposefully determined what they weren't going to do, where they weren't going to go. And it was all for very good reasons, but it does seem counterintuitive. I think the big takeaway I got from that chapter, which has all the steps of the strategic marketing plan that you need, is that a strategic plan needs to reflect ruthless choice making.
Well, you know what? The example you just shared, I had a CEO at one point. I won't mention which company, but we would be talking about something and I'm trying to drive choice making. And he'd say, "Kim, it's a genius of and. I want this and that." And I always thought it's so interesting. It's because he inherently saw risk in making a decision. Mm-hmm. And yet, I think at the senior levels of companies, this is exactly why people are paid a lot of money. Yes. You know, it's really to help direct the organization. He never wanted to make a decision. He didn't want to make a choice. And then the challenge is that the organization becomes overwhelmed and people are making their own choices, you know, about where they're going to allocate resources. And then you end up with, you know, potentially organization that's not moving together.
Mm. Yes. Well, let's move on to just a couple of the things in the time we have left here. I appreciate how generous you're being with your time. What was interesting for me is that you devoted chapters to certain topics, and it was almost like a barometer of what's on the rise and what's crucial for marketers. Remind listeners, you've got a whole chapter on influencer marketing, and remind listeners what that is and why, when it is done correctly, it is so incredibly effective.
Yeah, I mean, it's hot right now. You know, influencer marketing is just the ability to leverage somebody's influence to help build a brand. And so what I found interesting is I was invited to go over to China, and the way in which they think about building brands was absolutely different than the way – and by the way, I worked on a business globally back in the 90s where we had a lot of business in China. But what I'm seeing from the Chinese marketers from the East is that they tend to think about speed and, frankly, low cost, you know, speed of virality and low cost first, where in the West, we tend not to think that way. We've been acculturated to think about channels, you know, which channels do I want to use? We tend to be a little bit more patient on speed. And so they actually, the creative way in which they use influencers is quite striking. I think there's a lot actually that the West can learn from them. One of the examples I use in the book that I really, really like is when Tencent developed a campaign called Next Idea. Mm-hmm. Now imagine this. What they did is they wanted to overnight create awareness of a campaign that Tencent was doing to try to drive innovation. So it was a contest aimed at young people to get them to compete for the next kind of big innovation in China. And they were sponsoring this. And so they thought about multiple different ways of trying to drive awareness of this. They could do, obviously, advertising, et cetera. What they ended up doing is they brought a young man named Kerry Wang, who's an 18-year-old pop singer and very, very popular. Think of him as like the Justin Bieber of China. And then he brought on board Stephen Hawking. And this is obviously before he passed away. And what they did is they did these live question answer type responses. So what they ended up doing is they would have Wang ask a question of Stephen Hawking, and they would post the video, and then Hawking would respond in a video every few hours. They ended up with over 2 million shares, over 30 million views, all in a very short, rapid period of time, which is what their objective was. And it was relatively cheap and inexpensive to create. But what I love is this mashup, right? So they pick this young, appealing pop star that's going to get young eyeballs. Then they have an expert in the field, Stephen Hawking, big name. And they combine these two to create an event and an experience that would engage consumers through social media. So that's, you know, that's an example of a very unique way in which they're using kind of influencer marketing to try to drive awareness and engagement.
Yes, and I found it interesting, you quoted Stephen Chang, and he said that most Chinese marketers now think about influencers first, as they are often faster, more efficient, and more effective than other marketing methods. Whereas it seems like the United States, and you also mentioned this in your book, that it's like one of the last things they think about, and maybe it's a small little sliver of a budget, and they might give it to a junior person, sort of like saying, go buy a lottery ticket.
Well, I'll give you a very vivid example of this. We had an Celebrate Asia week at Darn. They asked me to speak, the students did. And so I came in and I said, all right, here's the question. You are now brand manager on a business, and you are told that you have to drive tremendous awareness of something, and you have to do it quickly, but you cannot use any traditional media. You're not allowed to use TV. You're not allowed to use digital ads, no money. How are you going to do this using traditional media? And here's what fascinated me, because I thought that it would take everybody time. My students from Asia, their hands immediately shot up.
Right.
And my Western students kind of looked, and they're like, well, what do I do if I can't use TV, if I can't use digital ads, if I, you know, how am I going to do this? And it was a striking kind of example of how they're just trained to think differently, mm-hmm. which is to think about how do I create virality first. One of the things, there's another case study in the book, the P&G SK2 case study, where they actually start looking at the influencers of influencers. Right. So they're looking at the micro influencers. Mm-hmm. Right. And so when you start becoming sophisticated at this, and you're trying to find, you know, you're trying to find a different way to influence behavior change or influence the way people think, you know, the easy way to do this is I go hire Kim Kardashian and put the product in her hand, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But as you become more sophisticated, you're trying to think about different ways in which you can influence them in an authentic manner.
And I've had about four books, terrific books on the show in the last 2 years about influencer marketing. And I'll include links to all of those interviews on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. Well, we're really running out of time. Let me just ask one big question about brand measurement from chapter 9. And I just wanted to quote where you write, being a capable marketing strategist means being able to measure the outcome of actions and programs. Thus far, we have focused on the development of strategies and plans that can help marketers effectively create and manage growth brands. While creating growth brands is a common goal across firms, a key challenge that marketers face is the measurement of a brand. As Peter Drucker has said, the purpose of a business is to create a customer. The conduit through which a customer is created is the brand, and as such, developing strong brands is a priority across most firms and industries. In the next page, you remind readers that CEOs would, in fact, like to see greater accountability from their marketers. So if you could just touch on, what does it mean to measure a brand?
Well, there's a number of different ways that you could measure a brand. So you could measure them through how much the consumer knows about the brand or how they perceive. You could measure them through their behavior, right? So when you look at a lot of ways in which marketers kind of measure elements, they're measuring different different aspects of the brand. The other way, though, but is through financial.
Excuse me, all three of those were from the consumer's point of view.
I was just going to say, I was going to say, another way that you can do this is from a financial perspective. So what's the value of the brand as an asset to the company? And so there are many different ways that you can measure it. And I'm not sure if I wrote about this in the book or not, but one of the things that I suggest when I work with different CMO groups is to really partner with their CFO. It's because...
Oh, you talked about how you had done that.
Yeah. I mean, I was really fortunate when I was at David's Bridal. I'm still close, very close to the CFO from David's Bridal. He thought more like a marketer, and I tended to be trained more like a finance person. And so I went to him when I first got there and said, you know, we're not effectively... measuring anything that we're doing, how can we partner together to make that happen? And so we then sat down and said, well, what do we want to measure? How do we, because it was a bit of a blank slate. What do we want to measure? How do we want to measure it? What exterior, you know, outside resources do we need to bring in to help support the measurement? And we really partnered on it, and it was terrific. It wasn't fast. We had to create a dashboard. There wasn't a really effective dashboard in place. But how do we know, you know, how to improve things if we don't know what, you know, if we're not measuring things? So at a macro level, there are kind of different areas that you can measure. At a micro level within company, within industry, all of that will vary. But the key is to try to step back and think about what you should be measuring now, and then who should you partner with to measure it so that you can move the business forward in a productive way.
Well, just so the listener knows, it's really comprehensive of all the different ways that you could measure. And I knew about some of these are really popular, but others I was less familiar with, but really, really terrific. So, Kim, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
The one thing that I would say is that I think positioning, okay, there's so much that's written on just kind of branding or on promotional elements. Positioning itself is really overlooked and undervalued. And yet it's a critical driver of creating sustainable competitive advantage. One of the things when I work with different executive audiences on innovation, I provide an exercise and say, walk through how you might innovate this business. They never think about positioning. And yet shifting the positioning of a brand, that was always my superpower. The first thing I'd do when I got to a business is I would assess the core positioning of the brand relative to consumers' needs and relative to competitors. And remember, there's one brand typically in a specific territory or in a specific category that has the best positioning. Or there might be a couple, okay, but not a lot. And so if you can, on the margin, shift the positioning of the brand, you can have great positive effect. We talked a little bit about values-based marketing. A lot of these companies are taking a position that inadvertently is shifting their positioning in the minds of consumers. It's not purposeful. They're not intending to do that, but they're reacting to a media question or query, and then they're inadvertently shifting the positioning. And that could have positive or detrimental effects. And so I think, you know, my whole goal here is there's a great recent Trout book on positioning. You know, my hope is to raise this kind of in our consciousness of saying this is really, really important, and how we go about developing a superior position in the marketplace, requires a lot of time and attention.
That was a very powerful story you told in the book about, I don't know which company it was you went to work for, but you did just that. You went in and said, okay, what is our positioning? And they had one, and then you did all that research, that a lot of it was explained in this book, and determined that they were wasting a lot of money, and they had some real blind spots in their positioning, which you fixed that, a lot of other things started to improve.
Well, I'm going to probably overstate this a little bit, but what happened is I came in and I looked, you know, I reverse engineered their revealed positioning, not what they had on paper, but what they revealed their positioning is through what they did and said. I looked at everything, and I then put, again, back into that Parthenon, I wrote down what their positioning was based on what they were, how they were behaving. I said, this is not a compelling positioning. And I knew that because I'd done this hundreds, if not thousands of times. But we don't trust my gut, my knowledge. We have to go do the testing. So we then went and tested the positioning relative to our competitors. Out of 33 brands, I believe it was 33, we were like ranked 28th. We had the 28th best, or if you will, one of the worst positions in the marketplace. And so I went to the CEO and said, we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars on marketing. Every dollar that we're spending reinforcing a weak positioning is wasted. I mean, that is the power. All of this money, all the stuff that we're doing, we're kind of throwing it, you know, down the chute just because we don't have a compelling positioning to begin with. And so as we talked about, we said, all right, how can we quickly improve our positioning relative to competitors so that we're not wasting this spend?
Terrific. Well, let's give the listener one thing they could do today to put in action one of the many ideas from your book.
So, you know, that's kind of challenging because each chapter has essentially a different tool. And so you kind of, you know, this is, you have to kind of go through and look at the tools to be able to put them into practice. But I would say, you know, one idea would be reverse engineering competitive positioning. So one thing, when you get on a new business, I always would step back and say, not what's on paper, not what our blueprint is. What are we actually revealing through what we're executing?
The reality, yes.
The reality of this, because that's what's landing with the consumer. And when you do that, you can then assess it relative to competitors. You can also come back and assess it relative to your blueprint. Is it in alignment with your blueprint? So that example I gave you a minute ago, one of the things that I observed is that the positioning was all over the place. Okay. Mm-hmm. So the way that they were executing it was inconsistent. Like one TV ad might say something different than another TV ad and different print and different digital stuff. It was all over the place. Mm-hmm. That led me to believe that we had a problem even in executing on our strategy.
And just so the listener knows, there's a section at the very end that talks about doing all these exercises that you can do. And one of them is on reverse engineering. And, this is something great for even training the marketers that work for you. So what books have most inspired your working career? You know, like what are some of the books that looking back had the biggest impact?
You know, this is an interesting question because there's so many, you know, first of all, I realized that when I was trying to answer this question, they tended to be books that were in my formative years.
Yes.
You know, so they're the books that you read when you're whatever, 18 to 30, that seem to really have this monumental effect on you. There's a number that I really loved, whether it's How to Win Friends and Influence Others, Championship Season by Lou Holtz helped me think about coaching, Nordstrom Way, anything with Kevin Keller. He's an academic from Tuck, and I love his work. But you know, the book that was probably the most instrumental on my life, so it's less about my work, but more about my life, was a book called Halftime by Bob Buford. And my pastor gave that to me in my mid to late 20s. He saw me working all the time, and he thought I was making a big mistake. And the essence of this book basically said that we live the first half of our lives for money, fame, and fortune. And then we realize that it's empty and we have a midlife crisis. What we're really searching for is meaning and positive impact, to feel as if we have value. And so when I read that book, I said, here's my goal. I'm going to retire when I'm 40. So to do that, I have to save money like crazy. I have to work really, really hard. I have to be very, very successful. But when I'm 40, I'm gonna choose a career that makes me feel incredibly fulfilled. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's why a lot of people will say, "Gosh, you know, you had that first career, you know, you were CMO, et cetera, and then you shifted, and now you're an academic." And by the way, I loved the first half of my. I loved it. I loved what I did. I loved working for P&G, PetSmart, et cetera. I loved it. But I love this as well. And I feel, you know, last night I was working with a student trying to help him with his pitch. I went to bed feeling like I impacted somebody that I could see.
Yes.
You know, when you're at a big company, you're impacting people from afar. And for me, you know, that's a very fulfilling. So that book was instrumental because it actually said, okay, Kim, go plan for your midlife crisis and you make it happen. Mm-hmm. Switch careers, you know, and so it really changed the trajectory of my life.
Interesting. I did not know about that book. I guess there's most books I don't know about. Halftime, Moving from Success to Significance. That looks terrific. Wow. Thanks for mentioning that. I think the listeners are going to appreciate that too. Well, listen, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we'll include links to everything linkable, including all the books that you've mentioned, that I've mentioned, to your LinkedIn profile and so forth. And a big favor, if you could, to the listener, please reach out to Kim and thank her for being on the podcast. You can reach out to her on Twitter or whatever and just let her know you heard it. I think it would really really make her day. I know the past guests have really enjoyed hearing from the listeners. And, you know, I think the listeners probably got a sense of what you're like and your personality. And I think we can all see why. And I didn't mention this in your bio, but you've won a lot of teaching awards and you're very popular with your students. So there's no surprise. So I think if you reached out to her, she might actually respond and maybe even answer some questions and get you pointed in the right direction. And if you're listening to on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on the show notes link. A couple of final quotes. Why do marketers exist? How do they contribute above and beyond all other functions? The book started by asking these questions and introduced the marketing impact framework. The answer is simple in theory. Marketers exist to help create positional advantage that drives profitable growth for a firm or brand over time. Therefore, the unique skill that marketers should bring to a firm is the ability to combine market insight, example being about consumers and competitors, with the firm's capability to define the strategies and plans to help companies achieve positional, brand, and financial advantage. And then on page, that was from 205, on page 206, my hope is that this book has demystified marketing and addressed the theory-doing gap by introducing a number of tools that can help marketers convert theory into effective practice. And finally, if you are as I was in my first general management marketing role, a fish out of water, then I hope that this book has helped you understand why you matter. Marketers help drive growth and how to develop greater marketing skill. It is a starting point to help all marketers, regardless of academic education or company experience, learn about the basic tools that can provide a common structure and approach with which to tackle marketing roles. I hope that this book enables you to understand some foundational tools, begin putting them into practice, and inspires you to continue learning about these advanced methods. The book is Positioning for Advantage, Techniques and Strategies to Grow Brand Value. The author is Dr. Kimberly Whitler. Kim, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much, Douglas. This has been terrific.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who have left an iTunes review, let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world and I'll drop it in the mail. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast and I read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message indicating that you're a listener so I won't mistake you for a spammer and ignore you, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. And remember the words of the entrepreneur and author Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune." Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.